Welcome to Lightning in a Bottle, the essential podcast for middle market business owners, key stakeholders, and the advisors who guide them. I'm Josh Pottinger, and joined by my co-host, Jason Chirogiannis. Together, we lead ATX Wealth Partners, a private wealth management team at UBS here in Austin, Texas. Now, over the course of almost 30 years, we've built a vibrant community and have curated a suite of resources tailored for your success, from insightful white papers and cutting-edge research to exclusive in-person events and expert-led podcasts. We are here to provide the tools that you need. Now, if you're considering an exit, this is likely the most significant financial decision of your life, and typically, you only have one chance to get it right. So our mission is clear: to arm you with the knowledge to enhance the value of your business, navigate a successful sale, and of course, optimize your post-exit financial outcomes. Now with that, let's dive in and unlock the strategies that will prepare you for a prosperous future. Hello everyone, Josh Pottinger here, and we are ready to rock with another episode of our Lightning in a Bottle podcast series. And I've got one of my, actually now former UBS colleagues, John Savercool on the line. John, are you there?
Yeah, Josh, I'm here. Hello.
Okay, very good. So John actually served as managing director and head of government affairs here in the United States. And back in 2003, he was actually selected by UBS to become the firm's first full-time senior lobbyist to direct the firm's advocacy activities in Washington. And we have been a big fan of John for many years and the work that he's done. He is the eyes and ears for us in Washington. And so we wanted to get him on an episode here just to kind of get a, update on what's going on. There's no shortage of things, right, John?
Yeah, and all kinds of things.
So before I kind of dig in, John, I wanted to kind of share with the audience a little bit about our team's Lightning community we've developed over the years and built up a distribution list, for lack of a better word, of founders and key stakeholders of privately held companies. And we've developed sort of an ecosystem of educational opportunities for these individuals to help them through the life cycle before, during, and after an exit. And part of that ecosystem is this podcast, where we bring on interesting individuals and specialists to talk about specific topics. But we also have private in-person invite-only roundtable discussions that we do about 4 to 6 times a year. And then in addition to that, something that we've recently started was what we call Spark Sessions, where we get this group of people, these founders, key stakeholders together periodically for a couple hours to have some drinks and appetizers and talk about some of the things that are going on in their world. And that's been a really cool recent addition to our to the things that we're doing. And I think founders really enjoy talking to other founders. So, and then finally, white papers our firm produces. And so between all four of those things, it creates a great educational kind of opportunity for founders to be engaged with other founders and to kind of learn tools and tactics and strategies on creating a more efficient outcome. So I'm going to stop rambling on that and let's get into what we are here to listen to learn more about, which is what's going on in Washington. John, I was this morning, well, one of the things that the firm produces on a weekly basis is called Washington Weekly. And if that's something you have an interest in getting, just shoot us a note. We're happy to put you on that list. But wow, this whole crypto thing, we've got rescissions, we're pulling back on spending, we've got the big, beautiful bill that just came through. There's some debate around that. Tariffs, that continues to be a headline. And got a little bit of Fed drama here with Trump talking about wanting to fire, maybe not fire, Chairman Jay Powell. So let's take a step back here, John. And you know, you've been at this for over 4 decades now in Washington as an insider to how the political and lawmaking processes work or don't work. Tell us a little bit about how Washington is different now than it was when you were early on in your years in Washington decades ago.
Well, thanks, Josh. And it's really great to join you today for this podcast. Yeah, I mean, Washington is you know, Washington changes frequently. It's certainly more partisan now than it has been for most of the time that our government has existed. I mean, neither one of us are old enough to remember the revolutionary days, but, you know, there's a lot of disagreements between some of the early cabinet members and, you know, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, John Adams, James Madison. There were duels where Hamilton was killed, one secretary killed by a sitting vice president at the time. I mean, that's pretty wild stuff. But I think now you know, when I was a younger man, if you reverse this by 20, 30 years, the way that most people got elected to the White House and to Congress was that they would try to win their primary. They would appeal to their primary election voters, a Republican trying to appeal to Republicans, Democrat to Democrats. Mm-hmm. And then once the general election came around, you would look to broaden your support and try to appeal to the centrists and to maybe some of the lukewarm members of the other party who aren't excited about their candidate. So, So you would essentially build a majority group of people, and hopefully, you know, you would win, you know, that way. And the person who could do that would generally win the election. That's certainly how the presidential campaigns were run. I think in more recent times, and this wasn't just in this past election, but maybe go back a few elections, 3, 4, 5, and the candidates have not really sought to appeal to the center, because that's not really where they are politically. They're worried more about their own party voters turning out. So if you're a candidate, you want to keep your party happy, keep them engaged. So you keep on appealing to them, and you don't go to the center once the primary election is done. You hope that you can win some of those votes, but you're not really trying to win them, because you can win if your party is so energetic that they're behind you, and if the other side is dispirited. And this is the result, I think, of the last few presidents we've had. They don't really feel any obligation to go to the center and to try to appeal to those voters. They're really trying to appeal to their base voters and trying to keep them happy. And I think that's the biggest difference. Uh-huh. And I think in the process, we've kind of lost some of the people in the center of the philosophical spectrum between the right and the left, have been kind of forgotten about, have not really been represented as fully as maybe they were in years prior. And, you know, frankly, I don't see that trend changing anytime soon. I think that's the kind of rut we're in right now, and that's provided for some of the lack of partisanship or lack of bipartisanship that we've seen. We just haven't seen a lot of it, because most people elected in office don't feel a need to accommodate those voters. They're really trying to placate their own voters.
What would you, like, if you had to assign a percentage on the Republican side as far as their base, and then the Democrat side and their base, who they're appealing to, like, and then the percentage of the people in the center, like, how would you allocate that?
Yeah, I would allocate that 40% to both parties. Maybe Democrats in registration have a few more voters than Republicans, although Republicans have been catching up in that regard. So probably 40% for each party. And then 20% truly independent voters, voters who will go back and forth, who don't feel strongly committed to either party. They want to vote for the person, and they're not so much concerned about the party. The registration of voters is a little less generous than that. Maybe it's 30%, 30%, 40% independent. But the reality is a lot of people who aren't registered to vote as Republican or Democrat have strong leanings to one party. So That's why I use the 40-40-20 ratio as, I think, being more indicative of where we are today.
Okay. That's interesting. That's a higher percentage than I would have thought. I guess I would have thought that there would be a larger number assigned to the kind of the independent or the central, center left, center right number, but that's interesting. Okay. So basically, bottom line is today's more partisan than it has been in history. Politicians are really just catering to their base now and not reaching across lines as much.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there are some exceptions, mm-hmm. but
yep.
the exceptions aren't enough to really make a difference. So
mm-hmm.
you basically have the House and the Senate and the White House, whether it's run by Republicans or Democrats, a lot of partisanship and not a lot of give to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
They want to win. They want to win, and they don't really care about the other side so much.
Right. Yep. Okay. Well, Washington's currently busy as usual, at least appears that way. What have they been doing, and what's on the plate here for the remaining part of the summer and fall?
Well, a big accomplishment by Republicans and Trump was the passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill, which contains a lot of different things. But I think for most people, the biggest thing is that it prevents taxes, individual taxes, from raising, from going up next year. They were scheduled to go back to their old rates if Congress didn't act. So it was, it's a pretty big accomplishment for them to pass the bill that doesn't allow that to happen. There's also some other tax provisions in there as well that I think are largely beneficial to individuals and businesses. So that's a big accomplishment. You'll hear Trump tout that as a reason for why Republicans should be reelected in the next congressional elections in 2 years. So that's a big accomplishment. I think otherwise they have to fund government. That's really the only thing that Congress has to do by law every year, is that they have to provide money for government to run.
Mm-hmm.
The fiscal year ends at on the last day of September. So September, October 1, that's a big day for that. That's, Americans don't pay a lot of attention to the funding scheme unless, it breaks down and there's a government shutdown or mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There could be a government shutdown. I think that Democrats are frustrated by Republicans winning on some of these spending issues. Republicans not only passed the tax bill, but they also passed a bill that would cut spending by about $10 billion by eliminating a number of agencies. So Democrats want to make themselves relevant in some way in the minority, which is not always easy. So you might see them take a more aggressive role in threatening to stop government funding if they don't get their way on certain issues, if they don't get domestic spending increased in some areas. And they can do this because the government spending bills do require bipartisanship. You really can't approve a bill in the Senate without 60 votes, and there's only 53 Republicans, so you need 7 Democrats to vote your way, and that's not going to happen. So there has to be some level of bipartisanship with regard to the spending levels of the government for fiscal year 26, which again begins on October 1. So that could be a big deal. We'll hear a lot of drama about government, about maybe government stopping or shutting down. So that could rear its ugly head. And I think that's really the big issue for the rest of the year.
Is the spending component.
Yeah, is the spending. And it's, spending's gone down a little bit, but then with the continuation of the tax cuts, that will drain some money out of the government's budget. So there'll be a big fight over which party is better on reducing the deficit and on reducing the debt. And the mm-hmm. reality is neither party is particularly good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And neither party has done a really good job of cutting spending and reducing the deficit over many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading the latest Washington Weekly, and it just talked about how the proponents of the Big Beautiful Bill, point out that the law cut spending by $1.5 trillion, which is the largest spending cut in U.S. history. But the opponents point out that any cost savings are overwhelmed by the tax cuts and increases in other spending, and that the bill would increase the debt by $3.3 trillion over the longer term. And then they also pointed out that net interest payments on the national debt are projected at $1.2 trillion this fiscal year. So we're throwing around some big numbers here.
The interest on the debt now exceeds what we spend on national defense.
Mm-hmm.
And Josh, the reality is that Congress can really only effectively address this by making reforms to Social Security and Medicare.
Right.
And they just don't have the guts to do it. The voters affected by those changes would object, and they don't want to incur the wrath of senior voters who are the most reliable voting bloc in America. So someone really has to take a leadership role in making this happen and in bringing our debt deficit within a more reasonable range and potentially eliminating the deficit and bringing down the debt. That it just seems like a pipe dream today. It can be done, but it requires courage, and it requires someone to lead, and it requires voters to understand what's happening.
Why it needs to happen.
Yeah, and to say, yes, I want that to happen. That's good for the country. May not be good for me personally, but someone has to recognize that's a beneficial thing, and we're not close to being there today.
Are there any solutions that you feel like make sense on the Social Security side? Either extending the date you can qualify for on or means testing? Like, what do you think is the, I mean, going a little bit off topic here, but I was just curious to get your thoughts on that.
I think it would be very easy to reform Social Security and to make it solvent for the next 70, 80 years. And you do that by raising the tax on income that is subject to Social Security taxation. Right now, it goes up every year by a model, but it goes up just a small rate. Push that up a little higher. So that would hurt people who are, you know, higher income earners who would have more of their money taxed by Social Security. But that's probably a good thing to do for the overall program. You can increase the retirement age. You can also limit benefits that people under 50 years of age are going to get and give them some alternatives to save in some other accounts that would be tax-free to maybe make up for some of the benefits that they might lose over a period of years. And then for people under 21 or 25, just kind of let Social Security reform itself by making these changes, and you give the people under 21 so much time to understand the changes and start to plan for themselves. I mean, Social Security would still be there, but maybe restore it back to its original purpose, which is to be a supplement for retirement income that people otherwise would have access to. Right now, too many people use it as a primary source. And as we all know, there's just not a lot of, you know, people aren't going to get a lot of money out of Social Security. They should get something, but it needs to be reformed. And I think maybe means testing some of the benefits, reforming some of the benefits, and giving some of the younger savers some alternatives to invest in certain funds that are tax-free. Something like that could be helpful. But I would say, Josh, that nothing's going to happen to Social Security in the near future. So people just retiring or people worried about having cuts in Social Security benefits, I don't want to suggest that that's going to happen soon. It's not.
Right.
The current structure is going to remain in effect for at least 5 or 6 years. And there is a point where Social Security becomes a little out of whack financially, and Congress will have to fix that. But that's, I think that's in about the year 2032 or something like that. So we still have a ways to go before that happens.
Yeah, gosh. I mean, we've been talking about the Social Security reform and Medicare reform for a long time.
Yeah.
Just nothing ever seems to materialize. Yeah. So, yep.
Everyone knows what the problem is. Everyone knows what the problems are. We all know that people are living a lot longer than the people who created Social Security and Medicare back in the 1940s thought they would live. Mm-hmm. Back then, men were supposed to die on average at about 64, 65. Now, people are living to their 100. So people are using the systems a lot longer than they we're supposed to, and that's a good thing, but we got to keep up with it and make reforms, and that's where the system has lagged.
Yeah. Because of the longevity continues to be extended out, although it did actually go backwards a little bit during COVID for a bit, but I do think with AI and the advancements in technology and biotech and drug development and stuff like that, we're just going to continue to be living longer and longer, which is just going to be a bigger and bigger drag. And one of the things that we will integrate into some of our planning is other ways to supplement the Social Security, right? To kind of tack on top of that for some people that are worried about longevity and running out of money, you know, and those are, there's certain strategies in place for that. Switzerland, I know they have a very interesting program over there. It's, I think, three, they have like three pillars. One is your like baseline, what would be our equivalent of a social security, which is to keep you from not having to live under a bridge. And then they have a second pillar that kind of layers on top of that, that gets you to, I'll probably butcher this, but you know, 80% of whatever your salary was before you retire. And then they have like an elective third peer that they could potentially, you could save for that puts you over the top. So there's certainly strategies out there. It's just getting somebody in office that can kind of make these changes.
And to have the political guts to take it on.
Right. So, well, every morning, President Trump, we see some sort of headline there. He's good at staying in the headlines for sure. You know, with him being in office just for 6 months now, would he be reelected if an election was held today?
Well, it's a good question. And I think he would be. Part of it is due to what you just hinted at, that he's in the news every day.
Yeah.
He dominates the media. Democrats really are trying to catch their breath. They don't really know how to respond to this rapid fire news session that we're seeing. By the time we get off of this call, there will be something else announced that you or I wouldn't have thought about. So it's a constant generation of news and constant exposure of Trump in one place or the other. The man is 79, but he's got tremendous energy. He feels that his term, his last term in office, only lasts 3.5 years. But in reality, it only lasts 1.5 years because that's how long he'll have Republicans in charge of the House and Senate. So he feels urgency to act, to get things done. 3.5 years or a single term is really not a lot of time, especially when he's still getting his appointees confirmed by the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a backlog of about 200 people there that are waiting to be confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that if you look at Trump politically, he won in the last election by winning Republicans and then by winning enough of those independent votes, more than Biden won.
Mm-hmm.
And he won because the issues of immigration and inflation, those two issues for the most part, and I think some social issues would be a third issue. Those were all issues that more independent voters liked Trump instead of Biden. They don't really like Trump personally, and they're tired of his personality and his fighting every day, but they liked his policies. They thought that Biden had just let things get out of control with the border and immigration and inflation, and on some of these social issues. So I think that the people who voted for Trump, the independent-minded voters, would say that, yeah, Trump has pretty much done what he said he's going to do. Illegal immigration is largely under control. He's deported a lot of the criminal illegal immigrants. He's deporting others. On the social issues, he's been loud and boisterous and a little cantankerous, but he's basically done what those voters feel is right. Probably hasn't made as much progress on inflation as he would hope. That's why he beats Jay Powell over the head every day and calls for his resignation. But I think overall, I think that the coalition of people who voted for him would vote for him again, and he would win, largely because he has pretty much done what he said he's going to do, and also because there really is no opposition right now. Democrats are just, they don't really have a plan. The party is split. This is common with a party that loses a big presidential election. They do a lot of soul searching, and you know, they've got to figure it out. They've got to figure out what the party wants to stand for. And they need to stand for something other than just opposing Trump. They haven't figured that out yet. They don't, you know, they still have time to do that because the presidential election's not till 2028. And maybe how they'll make a comeback is that Trump will make a lot of mistakes, and that could push people away from Trump. We're not really seeing that so far. I mean, surely about half of the country doesn't like Trump. Many don't like him in a strong way. But the people who elected Trump are what Trump's mostly concerned about. he doesn't really care if he gets 60-70% of the vote. He wants to get 50% plus one. Mm-hmm. He wants to get enough to win those electoral votes. And I think he would win if there was an election today. But we have time, and I expect Democrats to be very spirited in their run in 2028. There'll be a lot of candidates who will run, especially on the Democratic side. It's hard to know who might evolve out of that pack, but there will be a close race, you know, as there has been. But I would say right now, Trump is probably happy with his performance. And most voters who voted for him, the vast majority of them, would vote for him again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably a place politically that he wants to be.
Well, the question I had asked you earlier about the allocation of the population to the Republican and then the Democrat Party and then the independents in the middle may have answered my next question, which was Elon has mentioned the need for a third party to challenge Trump and Democrats. How realistic is this? Thought about this question a lot in the past, and it just seems like the system is just not built for a third party. And if the ratios that you kind of provided, it seems like a third party idea or realistic, a third party seems pretty low.
I have two thoughts on that. One is there is a market for a third party, in my view,
mm-hmm.
in America. I think there are a lot of people who are registered Democrats and registered Republicans who don't like Donald Trump or who didn't like Joe Biden. Now, they may have voted for them, but they didn't get them excited. And so I think that there are a lot of people in America who feel like neither party really addresses what they're looking for, and they're not problem-solving parties. They're parties that just want to beat the other side and, you know, be happy with their win, but they're generally unresponsive to people. And so I think that there is, and I think that there could be a chance for a third party to emerge and to be competitive. But I don't think it'll be Elon Musk's party. And I just think that he is just an awful spokesman for a new party. He's not highly regarded by most Americans. Democrats already didn't like him because of his association with Trump. Now Republicans don't like him because he broke away from Trump. There may be some people who admire him because of his business acumen.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, he's not widely and positively regarded
mm-hmm.
in the political arena. So I don't think he will be the face of any third party. He could try to provide funding for a third party, and any third party is desperate for money,
mm-hmm.
but still he would taint that party. I don't think you'll see much happen with Elon Musk in this third party. I know he's excited about it. Maybe he thinks it's realistic because he's been a guy who all of his life has been a doer and he's gotten things done that maybe other people didn't think he could do, but I think this is too tall of a task for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if there is a successful third party, it'll be another party. It'll be like No Labels or something like that. But it will certainly be a centrist party.
Mm-hmm.
But I would just remind you that it's really hard for a third party to be competitive. You indicated that, you know, we don't seem to have a system that's conducive to it. And I think that's right. It just takes a long time for a successful party to grow and to have the money to grow and to develop an infrastructure and to basically, you know, you're building a business. I mean, the Democratic and Republican parties are basically businesses that every day have people. I mean, people right now are working for them, making phone calls, promoting the party, promoting their candidates,
mm-hmm.
signing people up to vote, registering them to vote. It's an active activity every day.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, none of the third parties do that kind of work. They just, you know, they're just there in name only. And a new party would have to raise money to a great magnitude, get the organizational and infrastructure behind them, and, you know, sign up to run in every state. I mean, that requires a lot of effort and money. So it's not easy to be a new party. one could form and be legitimate, but it's going to be really hard. Remember, our last successful third-party candidate was your home state guy, Ross Perot, back in 92, and he won 19% of the vote, which is pretty good. But remember, we win elections based on their ability, based on the candidate's ability to win the states and the electoral votes associated with each state, and the winner has to get to 365. And how many electoral votes, how many states did Ross Perot win that year? He won none. He won as many as you did. So he won as many electoral votes as you did, mm-hmm. and history will show that he wasn't competitive at all, although at the time, it certainly felt like he was competitive. He was on the debate stage. He was relevant. The media covered him extensively. He was a very live actor, interesting guy, added a different voice on a big issue like trade. Mm-hmm. But it didn't translate to a meaningful impact on that election, other than maybe pushing the race toward Clinton and away from George H.W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear that even that happened.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have some other, I mean, the Libertarian Party that exists already. And it, you know, feels like a lot of the folks that kind of land in the middle probably align with that. Keep it government, minimal government, socially a little bit more liberal, fiscally conservative. But it just doesn't seem to gain any traction. And unfortunately, a lot of the representatives of that party tend to be a little, I don't know, let's just say kooky.
Yeah. I mean, they often don't have a lot of people who want to run under that banner. So they end up choosing someone who's a little different,
mm-hmm.
and is not acceptable to most people. And they get, you know, 2-3% of the vote. It never really mm-hmm. impacts the election.
Yep.
I think something could change, but it's not going to happen from the Elon Musk party.
Yeah.
And it's not going to happen by the next election.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to some kind of geopolitical issues. Things seem like they've quieted down a little bit, maybe in the Middle East, although I did see a few headlines recently with Iran and, you know, with the U.S. engaging in some bombing over there back in late June. You know, and then we've got the Russia-Ukraine thing. I've seen some more headlines recently on that, on imposing some additional sanctions and huge 500% tariffs. And what's the latest on the geopolitical side?
Yeah, there's a lot happening, and there's a lot of opportunity for the U.S. to play a meaningful role in a lot of these disputes that could blow up in our faces, but they could also be worked out successfully. In the Middle East, it feels like, I think most of us, and I don't know anyone who knows what the true impact of the U.S. bombing was on the Iran nuclear facilities. I've read a lot of speculation, but the reality is the only people who have really been in the facilities since the bombing are Iranians. And many of the nuclear scientists were killed. There weren't that many to begin with. So I think it's largely government inspectors in there trying to figure out to what extent the damages are. The UN hasn't been allowed in there. So we don't really know, or at least I don't really know. So I think we should watch Iran's behavior and try to guess. So if Iran is appearing to be more open and friendly, then yeah, maybe there was a real impact on the bombing. If they still continue to be combative, maybe they weren't as badly damaged as we thought. I noted today that they are agreeing to allow UN inspectors back into the facilities, but it's unclear what facilities are going to open up. And mm-hmm. so it's unknown. But in the Middle East, you have Iran, and then you have the situation with Hamas in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Israel seems like they want to go back in there and kind of clean up a little bit. There's still some rebels there creating mischief, doing bad things. I think that you'll see a ceasefire soon, and you might see additional aid. You might see some progress there, but progress is just so hard to come by but I think you might see progress. I think Trump has been a lot more accommodating to Israel than Biden was. So Israel is being a little more aggressive. And I think that's actually helping to accelerate decisions that other countries are making.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we'll see some resolution. I kind of think that's on a good path. I actually feel pretty good about that. And I think some of the other Middle East countries feel good about the recalibration of the region after the bombing and with the impending elimination of Hamas. So it may, you know, let's see how long it lasts, but I think that things are going better there than what we would have considered. If you look back 3 years or so, a lot of the feuding and daily attacks and things like that are just not occurring. So that's a good thing. I think in Russia, Trump has given Russia 50 days to agree to a ceasefire. Russia will certainly be aggressive over those 50 days. They'll try to win as much as they can on the battlefield before the 50 days is up. So if they agree, then they've won a little more land. It could easily be that Trump just gets so fed up with Putin and his intransigence that he applies what are called secondary sanctions on Russia, which Congress has to do. And that's kind of the wild card. And that would impose sanctions on countries that do business with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So any country that buys Russian gas would be subject to U.S. sanctions. And the result of that would be that those countries would just stop buying the Russian oil and
mm-hmm.
gas.
Mm-hmm.
And that could have a big impact on energy supplies and energy prices. So that could be a problem with the markets. We'll know that more in a month or so, but
mm-hmm.
I think that's headed, you know, I don't know where it's going, but I think it's a good thing that Trump is, I think most Americans want a resolution that is fair to Ukraine.
Right.
And I think the more that Putin is intransigent and the more fed up Trump gets, the more likely that will be.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see where it goes. I mean, those are two big opportunities for Trump. If he's credited with bringing peace or in calming things down, that would be a good thing for him.
Uh-huh.
But we're not there yet. And as I said earlier, things could reverse, although I don't think things are going to reverse in the Middle East for some time because Iran and the other rebel groups are just too weak right now to really do anything bad. So I feel much more confident about that than I do Russia, Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Were you kind of referencing the bipartisan Senate bill that would increase the kind of sanctions on Russia and
yes.
impose the kind of yeah. the secondary tariffs up to like 500% on imported goods
right.
from countries
right.
that trade and, with them. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that bill would give discretion to the administration,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, that's the bill. And I think that would be a big issue in Congress in September. If it happens, but Trump would have to signal that he wants that because no president ever wants their hands tied by a bill that tells him he has to do this. So Trump will have to request it.
Uh-huh.
So the next step is what does Russia do after the 50 days are up? If they don't agree to a ceasefire, I can imagine Trump telling the House and Senate, yeah, I want this bill so I can impose these sanctions. Then we'll see if Russia capitulates or not. If they don't, then the bill would pass and the sanctions would be imposed. They would be a big deal.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they would really hurt Russia hard, but it would hurt some other countries too. And again, affect energy prices and
right.
kind of throw that market into a turmoil.
Right. Let's finish up our conversation here with something we hear on a daily basis, tariffs, the outlook with tariffs for the rest of the year.
Trump has already imposed a lot of tariffs that are in place now that weren't in place at this time last year. And it's surprising that the economy just kind of accepted them, swallowed them, accommodated them without really triggering inflation. Now, there are some products, some sectors that have seen slightly higher inflation levels. But for the most part, the economy, like it did in the first Trump term, basically is managing the tariffs in a way that doesn't really wreak havoc. That could change. August 1 is the date that Trump has given countries to come to an agreement with the U.S. on tariff levels. If not, tariffs will go up to, I think, automatic 25% or something like that. So that's due to happen on August 1. That's why you're seeing all these trade deals being announced every day. Earlier in the week was Japan. The EU will follow later this week or next week. England was the first one. Philippines, Malaysia, I think a couple of others. So not all countries have reached an agreement with the U.S., but a lot of the big trading centers have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. That's a good thing. The other tariffs will go into effect. Hard to know how the market will react. Hard to know if Trump will again postpone them because he may feel he's got 8 or 10 other deals that just need another 2 weeks of negotiation. He's shown that he's willing to postpone. So it's hard to know what's going to happen on August 1, but there's the potential of higher tariffs going into effect in countries that don't have agreements with the U.S. That would be a big point of contention with the market, probably with the markets, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be like last time. The concern might be eliminated in the next couple of days if Trump postpones them or if he strikes deals. It's hard to say how tariffs are going to impact the markets, but so far, no big deal. But I think investors know they have until August 1 before the higher tariffs go into effect. So I think, you know, this is something to look at. I'm hearing that Trump will extend the deadline at least for most countries. He wants deals. He doesn't really want the tariffs. He wants better deals. And if we can get through this period of striking trade deals and avoiding the tariffs, that's, you know, it's probably a good thing. So That would give the market a little more juice. It's amazing to me that the market has been this strong. I mean, people feel good about the economy.
Yep.
They feel good about company earnings that have come out. The two things on the horizon that represent gray clouds would be the tariffs, if they're imposed on August 1, and the impact on energy markets if the Russia situation further deteriorates.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be in September, October.
Man, we have covered a lot in our conversation. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, John, and people will enjoy this particular episode. We have been trying to integrate some more timely conversations. A lot of our podcasts are more evergreen in nature. So this is all great stuff. You know, we covered the fact that Congress is more partisan today than in history. We've got this big, beautiful bill with lots of debate on whether it's a good one or a bad one. We've talked about Social Security reform and some possible solutions around there. Possible market for a third party, but probably not going to be Elon, and maybe a ceasefire in Gaza. The damage in Iran is still to be determined here. See how they behave. And then Russia, possible secondary sanctions on there could affect energy prices and tariffs. So sounds like the news cycle will continue to have plenty of fodder for headlines for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. If we did this in 2 months from now, Josh, we would have a completely new set of issues.
That's right. That's right. For the audience out there, if you're still with us, thank you for sticking around. And if you are not part of our Lightning community on our distribution list and would like to be added, and you're a founder out there or a key stakeholder, shoot me a note. We'll be happy to add you to the list and keep you in the loop. So, John, thanks again. Hope you enjoy the rest of your week and the weekend. I know you make it through Austin periodically, so let me know. We'll go overeat some barbecue and maybe listen to a little music.
Hey, I would love to do that. Would love to go to Saxon Pub anytime.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, John. Well, thank you very much and take care.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Lightning in a Bottle. It's been a pleasure bringing you today's insights from the brightest minds in business. To stay updated with relevant content, exclusive events, and our latest podcast episodes, send us a note to atxwealthpartners.com. Until next time, keep capturing the lightning of innovation and turning it into success. I'm Josh Pottinger, wishing you a productive and prosperous week ahead. And don't forget, know your options, be informed, and plan early. Take care and be well.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.